From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The spring migration is on, and bird migration is the subject of today's show with guest Ken Kaufman, author of the new book, A Season on the Wind. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden.
Ken Kaufman, originator of the indispensable Kaufman Field Guide series, is one of the world's leading naturalists and experts on birds. His lifelong interest in them began at age 6. He and his wife, Kimberly, director of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory, live on the west end of Lake Erie, where spring brings millions of birds virtually to their doorstep. And I'm so glad he's joining us today. Welcome, Ken. How are you?
Well, thanks, Margaret. I'm doing well.
Good. Well, congratulations on the new book, A Season on the Wind, Inside the World of Spring Migration. One of your earlier books is one of my favorite books, Kingbird Highway. when you take a sort of hither and yon, as you detail your own sort of migrations in a given year of your youth, hitchhiking around in pursuit of birds. Now, in this new book, you sort of stay put. Do you know what I mean? It's about bird migration, but it kind of takes place mostly in this birding mecca in Ohio, near where you live, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, in the past, I had traveled all over the continent and really all over the world to visit places where there were spectacles of migration, but I didn't really start to gain a deeper understanding of it until I spent some time just staying at home and watching what was happening in one place. Mm. And so that was what turned into the focus for the book.
So is there a master plan to springtime bird movement? I mean, do birds fall into some major categories of behavior having to do with their movements in spring, like how far they move or don't move and so forth? Are there sort of categories that we can understand as lay people?
There are some broad divisions and a complete range of birds, from those that are totally sedentary to those that travel long distances. There are hardly any birds that just really stay put completely for their whole lives. And even birds that we think of as residents, like cardinals, will move around to some extent within a local area.
Mm.
But then you have short distance migrants that are present. They don't have like totally separate areas on the range map. they may get a little farther north in summer and a little farther south in winter. Then the moderate distance migrants that may go from, say, central Canada to the southern United States for the winter, and then very long distance migrants that may go from, Alaska to Brazil or Argentina, and just these astounding long distance migrations. But there's every stage in between.
And the ones that go those very long distances, it's not optional. They have to do that, yeah? I mean, I think in the book maybe you call it hardwired, yeah? They're hardwired to have to do that. Whereas some of the ones that can move a little, they don't have to move quite as far. They can move a couple hundred miles or something.
Yes, that's exactly right. The long-distance ones, the hardwired ones, they're sometimes called obligate migrants, and then the others that can be more flexible will be called facultative migrants, and most of the latter are the short-distance travelers, and, an example would be something like the killdeer, which, they live out in the open fields here, and in where I am in northern Ohio, the last killdeers of the fall disappear sometime in early to mid-December, and then the first ones come back in February. So it hardly seems worth the trouble.
Right.
And they may only go as far as the southern part of the state before they turn around and come back.
Right.
But they can vary their timing and their distance, and they may travel, you know, they may come north earlier in a warmer spring, and so they've got the flexibility that most birds don't.
Right. So what are the triggers that say to birds, time to move? Is it just follow the food? Is it that simple? Or I think there's one of the chapters in the book, the new book, is called Creatures of Light. I think it talks about some triggers having to do with our response as animals, ours and theirs, to light and so forth. So what are the triggers that say it's time?
The ones that we know something about, a lot of them have to do with the length of the daylight.
And uh-huh.
The birds are really attuned to sort of the timing of sunrise and sunset. And as they change with the seasons, the birds will start to move. It would make sense to think they're just following the availability of food, but actually, if in fall, a lot of birds will fly south and fly away from habitats that are full of food. They leave before the cold weather arrives, and it's just the timing is set by the change in light levels. There'll be some places near the equator where that wouldn't work, and where they may be driven more by changes from wet season to dry season. But in North America, the length of the daylight really seems to be the driving factor.
Interesting. I mean, I noticed that living in a rural place, I noticed that about so many animals seem to know, and I shouldn't anthropomorphize, but I will anyway. I'll use words like seem to know.
Yeah.
but seem to, things change, the sounds in the morning. I was just talking about this with some birding friends yesterday. You know, there's that moment in later summer where the dawn chorus, the whole sound changes, and you see other kinds of animals doing activities, like you see more hoarding behavior among some animals that are going to, you know, hibernate or sort of semi-hibernate. Like the activities and the patterns change at a moment, and it can't be that everybody looked at their calendar, do you know what I mean, and said, oh, it's the day we're supposed to do this. Like, it must be the trigger of light, yeah, of day length.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it has to be, and I really do think that humans can become attuned to the regime of light in the area where they live.
Well, and you talked about that in the book, about you were kind of disoriented. You moved to Ohio, I don't remember how many years ago, from a different region, yes?
Yeah, in 2005, I moved from Arizona to Ohio, and I noticed almost immediately that it was different there.
Yeah.
including the light levels. And so I was sort of disoriented for a couple of years until I gradually became attuned to it.
Yeah. So speaking of light, does migration mostly take place in darkness at night, or are there some birds who move during the daylight hours?
That's one of the fascinating things about it, and one of the things that makes it hard to study is that there are quite a few species of larger birds that do migrate in daylight. Most of the hawks, for example, are daytime flyers. Cranes mostly migrate by day. Ducks and geese may migrate by day or by night. But most of the smaller birds, most of the songbirds, which are, of course, the most abundant ones, migrate at night.
Mm.
And so they'll take off just after it gets dark and fly through the night, and then if they're over land, they'll come down around dawn. Of course, this makes it hard to study what's going on up there.
Mm. And do we have an idea of why we think that's the case? Are they navigating celestial navigation, or is it because it's cooler at night? Is there a reason that we think?
There have been a lot of ideas tossed around for why they're migrating at night. The air masses may be a little more stable then. Mm. There may be fewer predators flying around.
Right.
The hawks are migrating in the daytime, so.
So if you're a songbird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes a difference.
I see.
They do use navigation by the stars, although daytime migrants can navigate by the sun as well.
Yeah. I remember years ago hearing about flyways, these sort of, I mean, as I visualized it from being told or reading about it years ago, the sort of highways or corridors in the sky that I imagined that, you know, birds travel during migration, you know, but that's not the way it's understood now, is it?
You're right. It's the idea of flyways was first developed in the 1930s when people first started getting lots of returns of banding studies of ducks. And ducks, to some extent, do follow sort of defined pathways because they have to move between specific water areas. And so you'll have, you know, even though they cross and they go in all different directions, you will have some sort of major routes of travel for the ducks. And so a guy named Frederick Lincoln named these flyways back in the 1930s as, you know, Atlantic, Mississippi, Central, and Pacific flyways. But mm-hmm. as it turns out, most birds don't follow those. And they don't concentrate. the birds haven't read the book.
Exactly. You know,
They don't concentrate in specific pathways. They spread out as much as they can, and they only concentrate where they're sort of forced to by geography. So if you could, especially if these nocturnal migrants, if you could look down at North America, like in early May, a night of peak migration, you wouldn't see rivers of birds flowing toward the north. Instead, it would look like a blanket of birds being pulled northward, stretching all the way across the continent, and with no real gaps except, you know, perhaps going around major mountain ranges, going around storms, that sort of thing.
Mm. Sort of strategic differences, things to avoid, et cetera. And you talk in the book, you know, about some, like the raptors, which you were mentioning before. They use the thermals. They use these. I don't even understand exactly what it is. But how do thermals work, and what birds take advantage of them? That's another word, you know, that I think people like myself have heard. Like we've heard about flyways, we've heard about thermals. What's thermals?
A thermal is just a sort of a bubble or column of rising air, air that's been heated by, you know, sunlight hitting the land or something. So the warm air rises in a particular spot, and birds of prey in particular will take advantage of those. They'll find this rising air and just spiral up into the sky, and then they get to the sort of the upper part of the thermal where it's becoming weaker, and they'll peel off and go gliding in the direction they want to go until they come to another thermal and then rise again. So they can go for miles without flapping their wings.
And so that's efficient, yeah. I mean, that's if you're going to go a period of time without eating, maybe you need to conserve energy. And is that sort of a strategic thing then?
Yeah, exactly. And for the birds of prey, it can be a challenge to, you know, they're the smaller birds may be eating all day, but for a hawk, it's a challenge to find prey when you're traveling. And so they. To the extent that they can save energy, they do.
Hmm. We learn, you know, we humans learn more about migration lately, partly thanks to sort of advances in technology, you know, tracking devices and radar or whatever. But like you give an example in the book of this, quote, champion thrush that was tagged with a device and then observed to fly nonstop, I think, across the Caribbean and all the way to Canada, you know, again, nonstop, pretty amazing. And you write, in sharing that anecdote, you then write, I love science and I hate it. And then you say, in a way, we know more about the birds' travels than they do. Tell me a little bit about that part of the story for you.
Oh, well, I was opening up there and admitting sort of the ambivalence I have about this. I've spent so much time reading scientific and technical works.
Yes.
Dozens of technical volumes and hundreds of scientific papers to try to understand the science of it. but I don't ever want to lose sight of the fact that we're witnessing something here that's just that's magical. It's a miracle, and just it should be just a total source of wonder. And I find that the more facts that I learn about the migration of birds, actually the more wonderful it becomes. The knowing more about how they do it doesn't make me any less impressed with the fact that it happens at all.
Mm.
I really feel like it's this massive worldwide miracle that happens twice a year, and I hope I'll never get over the sense of wonder at it.
Yeah.
And it just seems sad when sometimes people will take something and make a very scientific analysis of it and try to be, you know, dry and formal and technical because they feel like they have to do that to be scientific. And,
right.
I think, you know, the best scientists I've met have never lost their sense of wonder, like almost a childlike amazement and wonder at what we see out there.
Yeah. So speaking of facts, one in the book that comes back, sort of this riff that goes through the book, and it's not such a happy fact, but it's the fact that we humans, in trying the theoretical goal being to develop types of energy that are more green, that we may be causing havoc and harming birds by some of our tactics. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how that knowledge kind of came to you and with the wind turbines and so forth.
Okay. Yes, we, everyone I know who really pays close attention to birds is realized that the climate is changing. The climate is overall becoming warmer and weather is becoming more extreme. And we recognize that climate change is a real thing that has to be addressed. So I don't know anyone who's opposed to green energy or renewable energy, but there are some places where we have to be careful about what we put up. And, you know, wind energy can be really effective in some places, but a tall tower with spinning blades understandably can be bad for things that fly around in the sky. And so it's a paradox that we're not opposed to wind energy, but we think that location is extremely important.
Yes.
And certain types of places are such concentration points for birds that wind power really doesn't belong there. One example would be stopover habitat for these migratory birds. I mean, the area where I live in northwestern Ohio, birds that are migrating across the continent come down before they come to the edge of Lake Erie, and so we get massive concentrations of birds stopping over there, feeding, resting, getting ready for their next flight. So these nocturnal migrants are arriving in the dim light just before dawn. They're coming down and landing in this, you know, half light before dawn. They're taking off just after it gets dark at night. So at the times of day when the visibility is worse, they would be flying through the part of the air column that would be swept by the rotors of wind turbines.
Yeah.
So we feel that the wind power should be kept out of these critical stopover habitats for birds.
It seems so obvious, and yet the struggle that you depict in the book and probably others that have been happening in other areas that you talk about in your area that you and your wife and others have sought to change to get it out, get that kind of a project out of that type of a habitat, it's pretty shocking. Again, it seems obvious that we should avoid this, and yet we're not avoiding this. That was a.
It should be. It should be obvious, shouldn't it? I mean, you know, if we wind turbines, we shouldn't put them up like at the end of the runway at a major airport.
Yeah,
you know, that's not a good place for them.
Yeah, yeah, Yeah. In the last few minutes together, I wanted to, you know, it's the time, it's migration, spring, and you know, you've been watching migrations for a long time, and you're an expert at this, an expert observer. I noted that, I think it was the Audubon website where you're a contributor, they did an excerpt from the book, and I think the headline was something like, "Backyard is one of the best spots to witness bird migration." Is our backyard the place we should become a more astute observer of migration? Or tell us like a little bit of, you know, invite us to the places we should go or what kinds of places we should go.
I really feel like the backyard is the, the best place to look. I know not everyone even has a yard, but
yeah.
Any local park, any little area of garden, or you know, public gardens or semi-natural habitat is a place to observe bird migration because it is happening on a broad front. You don't have to live on a flyaway, but we all live on a flyaway.
Right.
You know, we're all there. So just getting out every day and just looking around to see what happens, migrating birds will come through. And in the book, I talk about, you know, I live in a place that's great for migration, but a lot of the book focuses on things like robins and red-winged blackbirds and common birds, song sparrows, how they respond to the arrival of spring, and staying in one place and watching the season unfold, I think, is the best way to learn about it.
Yeah. I find kind of inspiration and validation maybe also in participating in, and I don't do it, you know, in a major way, but I do it a couple of times each week in a citizen science kind of a thing like ebird.org, you know, of recording my sightings, you know, the first day that the male rose-breasted grosbeak showed up for this spring in my yard last week, and, you know, who's around each day. Today was a wood peewee, eastern wood peewee, and so on and so forth. I love going there and seeing, exploring in the explore area, seeing in my county that someone else saw a similar bird a day or two before or whatever. You know, it's that sort of sense that it's happening in a bigger way, even though I'm only in my backyard looking out the window. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to take part in it. I'm addicted to eBird and our sightings there. And I just love the way it reveals things, like there were three red-breasted nuthatches out in the yard the other day. And it could have been just a fluke, but I went to eBird and started looking around, and there were red-breasted nuthatches passing through all over the area.
Yes.
At the same time. So it puts our own sightings in context.
Yes.
A wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love the book, A Season on the Wind, Inside the World of Spring Migration. Ken, are you writing something else now, or are you taking a little bit of a break?
I think I'm going to be continuing to work on books probably for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I can't help it either.
I'm also very much enjoying the brand new edition of your book.
Oh, good.
Vedegaard. It's just wonderful.
Oh, good. I
love your prose style. And,
Well, that's very sweet. So, that's a high compliment because I've been, as I said, reading your books for a long time, and both the literary ones, the ones like this, and also the field guides. So that you kind of founded that group of field guides. I have many of them in my on my shelf next to where I work all day and always looking things up. So thank you so much for this and for those.
I'll send you a note once I get close enough to having another one ready
good.
To come out.
Good, good. Well, thank you for taking the time today. I'll talk to you soon again, I hope.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Instagram or Facebook as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and bird watching meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.